The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis here with my ever effervescent co-host, Bill Hunt, a man who uses the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to justify his waning short-term memory.
Where am I?
Exactly.
I have no idea.
All right, so the title of today's show is The Scientific Method. Note the way I say it, Bill, because nobody really cares about science and the scientific method.
You make your own reverb there. That's good.
I like that. I think it's better when you're like introducing a movie. In a world where two geeky scientists use something called the scientific method, where scientists are king, but the football players still get all the hot chicks anyway. No.
Yes.
So that's what we're talking about today. And as we often begin the show, we'll start with science in the news.
Right. So this one, again, comes from the International Herald Tribune, the only...
You like the International
Herald. It's the only... I don't trust any of the U.S. news sources anymore, but that's...
Bill Hunt and his conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Can you... You can't subscribe to that in the United States, can't you?
I get it on the web. I don't know if you could get it delivered or not. Probably could.
Because when I lived in Europe, I subscribed to it.
Yeah,
and
Japan,
it's a fabulous paper.
Oh, I've got Japan and every place else.
But
anyway, this is about Hewlett-Packard unveils new memory technology. It's based on resistors. It's a device called the Memristor that could possibly build extremely dense computer memory chips that are far less powerful or require far less power than today's DRAMs, which is dynamic random access memory, and are rapidly reaching the limit in how much smaller they can be. It's made out of little tiny nano dots of, let's see, the material is titanium dioxide. And
well, that's commonly used in a lot of products.
4 nanometer scale, and the it's interesting here they say the size of a transistor is 45 nanometers. That's just the size of the gate length. That's not the actual physical size of the whole device.
Right, that's actually bigger than that.
But anyway, it was predicted by Leon Chua at Berkeley in 1971, and he coined the phrase Memristor. And so they point out that it's been around for 40 years, essentially, so it's not likely that any patents are going to withhold be held there. Yeah. But, so there are many efforts to make memory and store data. So basically the point is to impose a physical state on a device that you can read out later, and hopefully it would retain that data. For long, so charging a capacitor, MRAM for magnetic random access memory is based on spintronics, and IBM has chips out on that. So the idea is to get a lot of memory, smaller space, read out very quickly with fidelity. This is actually analog. There are a vast array of intermediate values between on and off here.
Right. But this one's based on electrical resistance.
Yeah, and they kind of give a little teaser here that it involves one layer of titanium dioxide and a second layer of titanium dioxide doped with a material that they're not going to tell you what that
is. Right, I knew it's got to be something more complex than titanium dioxide. I mean, titanium dioxide is a mineral used to make products white. You may find it in everything from your toothpaste to consumer products.
Jackson, for example.
Right,
you might find
it
in a product like Michael Jackson.
But you're going to have to define that one, spintronics.
Spintronics is not a Motown group from the 60s.
Yeah, I think
a lot of people thought it was.
Spintronics.
And it's basically, it filters out electrons that only have a certain spin, say spin up or spin down.
Right.
And so the voltage that's applied to impose a particular spin filtering process, that's the information is that. And so then we drive a current through, you get a much lower current if it's on versus
off. So the spin state of an electron, kind of complicated. We've talked about this before, previously, when we were at Radio Sandy Springs, when we talked about NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, because depending on the size of the magnetic field, you get different energy differences depending on the spin state.
Right. So the idea is that the electron is spinning around like a top.
Okay.
And it's either spinning around with, if you put your fingers in the direction of that spinning, either it's up,
your thumb would be up or your thumb would be down. Right.
And so that's what spintronics is based on. And,
okay.
and a lot of these things, the people working on it work on it for years and years and years before it becomes a product.
Right.
So this is a good example with Leon Chua in electrical engineering at Berkeley, coming up with it in 1971, publishing a paper,
right.
and here we are, 2008, and a device is finally coming out.
And often it takes a lot of research in material science.
Exactly,
to make it
and that's exactly what this is, material science, and you got to do it repeatably and with consistency and uniformity and all that. So that's our science in the news.
So at the risk of causing a repeat of your final Rhodes Scholar interview, why does the average person care about this?
You won't repeat that.
I'll bring that up as
that
much
pivotal
as
moment
can.
That's painful for me to even think about.
Yeah.
But, it's a way to, you know, think about the memory in your computer and your, you know, your cell phone. You've got all those addresses in there. And it's just staggering how much more information is being stored. When I was in, entered college in 1972, you would go into the computer facility, and they would have these magnetic cores, little ferrite beads, and you pass a current through it, and it would impose a magnetic field direction in that core, and that was the magnetic storage for the longest time. That was magnetic storage. Then went electronic, and that's, you know, nobody really uses magnetic core memory anymore.
We remember thousands of words, kilobytes.
Yeah.
And then we went to megabytes.
Right.
And then gigabytes and terabytes. You can buy a terabyte drive now or a half terabyte drive just for your home computer. And they're even...
Well, you can on your paycheck, but...
Well, that's true. If you actually had a reasonable job, you could. But and now they're talking about petabytes? Peta's the next one, right?
So I don't know.
Gigas, that's trillion...
Peta might well be. I don't really know.
Gigas, trillion...
But, so, I mean, the idea is the mantra has always been, you know, faster, smaller, cheaper. So you got to read it out fast, have it archival, maintain the integrity.
Cheaper and higher density memory for everything from your computer to your cell phone.
Right.
All right, that's important.
Right.
Certainly the
so that's where it all comes down,
All right, so today we're talking about the scientific method. And before we start with that, I mean, what do you think the average person thinks of when they think of science?
Well, you know, I was... Brad, what do you think? Yes.
Brad's giving me the look now, like I'm looking at him, expecting him to be the normal person, but he's a tech undergraduate you're in mechanical engineering, right? So he's not normal either.
No.
Right, but if you have any, you know, just grab the mic and chime in.
Right. But, I mean, I don't know what the average person would say if you ask them on the street what science was. I mean, it's from the Latin word scientia, meaning to know. So it's about knowing.
Right. I think the average person thinks of it as the body of knowledge we've discovered using the scientific method. You know, this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think that is part of it, I think that's the lesser of the two parts. The most important part is the systematic mechanism by which we know that, the scientific method.
Right. And that's actually changed through history. You know, the first, being the historian guy that I am, one of the earliest... bits of evidence of the scientific method is in ancient Egypt, the Ebers Papyrus, circa 1550. It's evidence of traditional empiricism related to medicine.
Okay,
so,
and we've got to define empiricism and empirical before we go on.
So empirical basically means is a fancy word for saying experimentation. So you do an experiment, you learn something about it, and you observe what's there. And this is kind of at the heart of the scientific method. I'm actually, with all the reading that I did on this, I want you to explain what exactly the scientific method is, because it's morphed through history. You had Socrates, who's almost, he cast a long shadow that basically, between that and the Catholic Church, inhibited the progress of science and Western civilization for about 1,000 years. And he viewed geometry, so he viewed science as learning new stuff. And science is what we can learn. Geometry and the other sciences, like shoemaking, are techniques of other artisans altogether or considered separately. So he set out that using geometry, he made a distinction or bifurcation there between learning and math and science and technology of shoemaking. And I think that really held things up considerably, because there's just, you know, in reality, if you look at, like, describing light as a wave phenomenon, that makes sense, because you can go to a pond, throw a rock in, see what a wave is. You see a wave, and you're making an analogy between what a wave is and this light phenomenon, which you can't really see what that's going on. So I think that kind of held things up considerably, you know, that kind of view. And there was also syllogistic reasoning.
Syllogistic?
Syllogistic.
It's not a new dance move that you picked up at the club.
It's a dance move I have, but I don't think you could ever possibly
I think I'd break a hip.
You would.
All right,
you would.
So what is syllogistic?
It's deductive reasoning, or induction, rather. So, you know, it might go something like, you know, Einstein was a genius. Einstein forgot to wear his socks. I forget to wear my socks. Therefore, I am a genius.
Yeah, I think we all see the fallacy in that one.
Yeah, it's a bit faulty. So, I mean, it tries to succinctly induce to a point, get induction to a final, you know, conclusion way too quickly, and just strictly based on analogies that are not necessarily too tight.
So I'm going to step in here, and before I comment on that, remind people that this is a pre-recorded show. So if you're listening to this thinking, wow, these guys are really boring this morning,
or
I better call
in. Or if they sound dead, it's because it's not a live show.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
For someone who partied way too much during Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah. Well, that was
which
you.
Is,
not me.
We're recording the day after.
Not me.
I was up working on a boring talk.
Yeah.
Okay. I think, ladies and gentlemen, we've clearly illustrated why nobody cares about science so far.
I mean, I think it's interesting to look through history. And there was also this guy, now I won't be able to pronounce, Ibn al-Haytham, in like the 10th century in the Muslim world. Who actually pushed things forward from Aristotle on the scientific method.
Oh, yeah, actually, during the Dark Ages, a lot of science and math flourished among the Moors in Spain and throughout the Middle East.
And he had a book on optics.
Yeah. The word algebra is Arabic.
Mm-hmm. So. And so, you know, he tried to do so. And then in Western civilization, there was a guy, Robert Gross Testy. How'd you like to have that name?
How unfortunate.
Yes. And anyway, Roger Bacon at Oxford University followed him. And so there's this slow progress through a millennia, basically, there of trying to, you know, start to get a grip on what the scientific method is. So it's not a simple thing. So I'm going to turn it to you, since I'm kind of confused now reading all this. Explain, please,
right,
sir.
So we've not only confused
Professor,
the audience,
a lot of us, we've confused.
We've confused the host as well. I
yeah.
know I'm confused.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go through the history and how it's subtly changed over the years. But I would say that the greatest practitioners that most people can relate to of the scientific method today are certainly not you and not me and not scientists or research engineers. They are your plumber, your auto mechanic, and your electrician. And that maybe illustrates the importance of the scientific method, that they go into your house, you've got something stopped up, you have a physical observable, right? Sink A and sink B don't work. Is it a, and you formulate a hypothesis. We do this as well. You decide, is it the trap underneath the sink? And you can take that off.
Well, why don't experiment. You back up? So what is your definition of the scientific methods?
Okay,
before
so
we compare it to
so
plumbers
I'm going to turn to something that anyone can
blue
look
jeans
up,
that are too
rather
low
than
or something
the,
like that.
The giant tome. Can I use that? The giant tome
you
or
can.
Stuff?
No, you can.
From
yes.
You. I'm going to go to the Science Buddies website, just because it sounds friend. Science Buddies, right?
Right
it's not,
right.
you know, Einstein and Max Planck. It's, we're your
buddies.
The Science Buddies. That you can find at www.sciencebuddies.org. They explain that the scientific method is a way to ask and answer scientific questions by making observations and doing experiments. I think that's a good definition, right? That you ask a question, and that's the first step. They say the steps of the scientific method are to ask a question. If you're an engineer or scientist, rarely do you ask that question. That question is thrust upon you.
Right? Right.
Something went boom, you know, in
well,
the factory.
And it's how much do you want to know? So, I mean, I've seen it with industry, a lot of times the push is to understand it well enough to do something with it or fix a problem, but not mm-hmm. necessarily truly to understand the underlying processes.
Right, and that's the difference between empirical and fundamental science. Mm-hmm. You mentioned empiricism, and that's mm-hmm. doing experiments and reinterpreting the experiments over and over again. Mm-hmm. Empirical science, which is no less valuable, that's really applied science, that's really what we do, mm-hmm. engineers,
yes, right.
Is understanding what happens when you do what. Fundamental science is understanding the fundamental why behind it.
Right.
So do we need to take a break here? Okay, so let's take a break back. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll go through the various steps suggested by the Science Buddies website on executing the scientific method. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Want to support WREK? If you would like to underwrite, visit our underwriting page on www.wrek.org or send us an email at business.manager@wrek.org.
As an employer, you may hire teens during the summer. For many, it will be their first job. It's your job to provide them with safe working conditions and teach them how to work safely. Join OSHA and construction professionals nationwide to help build a safe work foundation. For more information on how to protect teens in the workplace, go to OSHA.gov or call 800-321-OSHA.
A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
At the karaoke bar, Greg shows the telltale signs of being wasted. First off, he's in a karaoke bar. Next, he tells the waitress she can be his backup singer. Greg asks his buddy if he met his backup singer. He takes another shot and realizes he's not sitting with his buddy. Then he spends an hour searching for the perfect song in the food menu. On stage, he can't read the lyrics on the monitor. He explains to everyone that he can't read gobbledygook. Greg decides to freestyle rap. He keeps repeating the line, "I don't read no gobbledygook, boy." The power is cut, and Greg offers to sign autographs out back.
It's easy to tell if you've had way too many to drive, but what if you've had just one too many to drive? Never underestimate just a few. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back. You know, for 25 years, he's never rolled over about fighting crime. Welcome, McGruff the Crime Dog.
Thanks, Joy. I got two words to make streets safer. Coffee cake.
Yeah, the crook eats the poison coffee cake. And
No. You invite neighbors over for a cup of coffee to discuss the problems on your street and what to do about them.
But still, a 10-pound cake dropped on a bad guy's foot could help.
Couldn't hurt. Going to WePrevent.org could help, too.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, where we're talking about the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think I've got my second win now.
I think you have.
Right, and we went to that well-respected website, sciencebuddies.org, to get a definition of the scientific method. And mm-hmm. they claim there are several steps in the scientific method. The first, of course, ask a question or mm-hmm. have a question mm-hmm. thrust upon you by your boss who says, look, if you don't figure this out by next month, you're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Next, do background research.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that wasn't around at the beginning of the scientific method. It's only around now after we stand on the shoulders of giants.
There was no Google back.
Well, there weren't libraries,
mm-hmm.
right? Things
right.
like that.
Right.
And a librarian will easily give you a lecture here on Georgia Tech and the importance of mm-hmm. that. Librarians think that anything worth doing has been done. Scientists think anything worth doing hasn't been done. So we
right.
go off half-cocked and say, okay, we're just going to do something new. In fact, that's what Feynman mm-hmm. did. You said Richard Feynman, mm-hmm. Nobel laureate from Caltech.
Right. Yeah, he was, and this was in James Gleick's book, Genius, about him. He was actually kind of the anti-intellectual. He didn't like to read anything. He never wrote anything that you think he wrote, like the Feynman lectures on physics. He didn't put pen to paper on that. And he would always go.
Yeah, people just took it down for him, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right. And Feynman and Hibbs and all that. He basically went into areas that the ground had not been plowed before. so that he didn't have a lot to read. He didn't have a lot of background stuff to clutter his mind with. He would just go after it. So those are interesting things. You've got, you know, looking at the background information, but, you know, I think inherent in your screen turning off there is that...
he's looking at my computer. You can get You're easily distracted like a monkey at the zoo, man.
Yeah, wave. Yeah.
Are you going to throw bananas at me next?
Well, look at that screensaver. also one needs to... I guess I'm babbling here, but you know the thing is the scientific.
Yes, indeed you are. Yes, I am. I'm happy to step in and confirm.
Yeah,
that.
No, you're not. You're happy to sit there and watch me.
And you're using your hands
drown.
In an interesting way. It's,
yeah, yeah.
So you're John Lovitz with that, and so you're off to France.
Right. Yes, you are. But I mean, there's a, you know, the scientific method. The phrase sounds so restrictive and cast in stone. But I think there are a lot of nuances.
Yeah, there are.
And as you say, the shade tree mechanic who's fixing your car and actually thinking about
what
it.
What is a shade tree mechanic? Is this?
You're obviously
this
not
is not from, Mr. Goodwrench. Apparently.
You're obviously not from Mississippi. This is the guy that can do a brake job and roll back your odometer. That's that guy.
Okay.
But he has to sit there and figure things out. He doesn't just connect it to a computer and have it tell you, oh, this, you know, replace this. Yeah. He's got to think about it, think through what it is.
Yeah, that's so the scientific
that's,
method. Yeah.
You know, not looking, here's the data, oh, the check engine light is on, do this. Yeah. You know, that's not the scientific method.
Yeah, they listen, they take apart,
yeah,
they drive
so it's thinking it through, but it gets to be one of these things where, you know, has the sound of something very restrictive and precise.
And it's not.
And it's not.
You're absolutely right. Another reason to do the background research, part of it is just to find out if someone's already done it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm embarrassed to admit how many times we've had an idea, we thought about writing a grant, you go to the literature and you realize someone has completely solved the problem.
Well, for whatever.
And you can go home.
Sorry to take a tangent left here, but...
Well, you're good at that.
That's what I do. That's how I roll. But... this biography of Paul McCartney.
Boy, did you take a tangent.
Many years from now. It'll become apparent in a second. But he said that Ringo Starr once spent 3 hours writing a song, and it was like in the top five. You know, he had a tune in his head, and he was getting it down, and turns out it was on the radio.
And he heard it before, right.
So that's sort of the extreme sense of looking at background work.
And the other reason to actually do reading in general, mm-hmm. is oftentimes you find a theory, an idea, a model in one field that is very applicable in another.
Right. And I would say that a lot of the big advances in engineering that have been credited are really just transpositions from one field to another.
Shifting an idea from one field to another.
I worked at Harris Corporation with a guy, Bud Vanderloop, who is famous for something called the Vanderloop filter. And this was before an age of a lot of computers, people tried to do...
this is, what, something that filters dog hair out of your...
No,
pool, the Vanderloop
no, no.
Filter.
That would be your teeth. But it was a way to have an optical image go through a film. So with lasers, pass it through, and if you're trying to detect a specific thing there, it was a matched filter. So it would allow the image through, essentially, if it was exactly the image you were looking for. Mm-hmm. And this matched filter technique was from radar. So it had been there in radar, but he just applied it to optics. And he was a great guy. I worked for him. But that's an example of he knew matched filters in the... radar world really well, mapped it over to optics, the Vanderloop filter.
Right. And this happens quite a lot in engineering.
And to a lesser extent in science. You know, you don't quite have...
No, but I think it does. People steal models all the time. I take population models, which you can use to keep track of, polymers in a solution, and I use it to teach a population of students at a party to my numerical methods people and show them how... Because it makes it relevant. Actually, want to learn about that rather than...
Well, another good example there is Volterra, who was a math.
He's an action hero. Hang out with Wonder Woman.
Yes,
Volterra.
He did. He wanted. He wanted to hang out with Wonder Woman.
Who didn't actually?
I know. Yeah. Well, let's. now my mind just won't be able to work if you get me on Wonder Woman.
You can't get that image out of
but,
your
head. No, so he was a mathematics professor in, I believe, the 1700s who got hired by the Hudson Bay Company to explain to them why on these islands in the Hudson Bay area they would, you know, one year they would come in and the trappers would have lots of fox furs and very few minks, and then 2 years later they'd have tons of minks and no foxes, and they couldn't get a steady flow mm-hmm. of furs out. And so as a consulting job, he went in, kind of like an earlier day Pete Ludovis flying over to the Middle East all the time and mm-hmm. being on the TSA watch list for going to the Middle East so many times. He went and studied it and came up with what's called predator-prey models, or the Volterra model.
Yeah.
So a couple differential equations, birth-death processes.
Right.
It describes lasers. It describes
so it swung
coupling
back and forth.
Of modes.
Were the fox eating the
yeah,
mink?
Yeah, right, right. Okay. So when the foxes would rise up in population,
they'd eat
all the minks. They start starving to death. They start dying off. The minks
yeah.
start coming
yeah,
back,
okay,
and it fluctuates.
Right.
And so it's used in economics and a whole bunch of other areas. So it's as you say, it was he developed it,
yeah.
but it got applied to a lot of different. And you know, the first person to apply. In my own field, this kind of model to surface acoustic wave devices got a name for basically for themselves for basically mapping,
right.
18th century mathematics
wow.
onto devices today. So,
okay, so our next one after do background research, our next mm-hmm. step is construct a hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
and that's really what a statement of what you think is happening.
Right.
Right. So, for example, I'll go back to my daughter's fourth mm-hmm. grade science experiment because everyone can relate to that. I had a hypothesis some years ago after spending many, many hours late in the lab or the mm-hmm. office eating your dinner out of the vending machine.
Mm-hmm. That only you would do that. Grad students do that.
Well, when I was a graduate student.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So
I'll let you off the hook there.
I had a hypothesis that the cream filling amount mm-hmm. in an Oreo cookie in a vending machine was less.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the observable, they tasted drier.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my hypothesis. So how do you test that hypothesis, mm-hmm. right? And that's the next step. Test your hypothesis doing an experiment. Luckily, I had my daughter do the experiment. She measured the amount of cream filling
mm-hmm.
in the vending packs and in the store pack, and
mm-hmm.
they were spot on, almost exact.
Hmm.
So I have to
now,
hand
this
it
is
to,
mass,
this
right?
Is, yeah, we did mass. We did
okay.
mass.
So the mass.
And actually, we measured the height of them, and actually, if you believe the cookies have the same
mm-hmm.
height, it appears the volume is the same as well.
Really?
Right.
Okay.
So density is the same.
So how do you, is it just that it was late and you shouldn't have been eating
well,
Oreos anyway?
So here's
too much
the interesting
coffee.
Thing. And this is what you find out. So we disprove the hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
basically. And a lot of graduate students get upset when you disprove a hypothesis. Like, mm-hmm. well, okay. But that's when you often learn the most interesting stuff. What we learned is that the sandwich cookie differed by, 7%. And that
mm-hmm.
was statistically significant. We
mm-hmm.
may get a chance to talk about that in a later mm-hmm. show. Meaning that, there wasn't a huge variation. And just if you pick one, okay, it was less than the other. Basically, all of them were less.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the variation about that data, it was relatively small compared to the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So the cookie was heavier in the store.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we discovered.
Wow.
So,
okay.
So any thoughts?
Water
on why
absorption?
That okay, that's exactly what I believe
mm-hmm.
it is because we use different materials. The
mm-hmm.
one in the vending machine is a metal and plastic laminate. In fact,
mm-hmm.
we may have talked about this previously in the polymer show. It has a very low permeability of water
mm-hmm.
and oxygen and things like that. Whereas the cellophane, which is a good material, it's much better than, your polyethylene bags
mm-hmm.
you use at home. It's not as good as the metal.
Right.
The metal's very, very good. So there you have it.
Well, yeah, as your daughter's working her scientific way through snack foods, growing up, the soft drinks out of glass bottles.
Yeah.
Nothing tasted so great.
Yeah, so
it was
why
so
is
cold.
That?
I don't
Do
know.
Have
I, don't know. I have no idea. I mean, is it that they were colder? Is it they didn't have metals in them that had leached off the side
possible,
through the process?
Yeah.
But they just tasted
yeah.
so refreshing, so much more than in the can.
Yeah, but the modern can is coated, so
mm-hmm.
it's not bare metal there as well.
Right. But maybe it was the lead, the excessive amount of lead I was ingesting, from those. I don't know.
You just ate that as a hobby. Right?
Yeah.
Spread it on
yeah,
crackers.
Yeah.
And
but it just there was an apparent difference. Now, interesting thing there is I would think that one would want to not have the hypothesis drive what you look at and what you try to find.
So, you'll have to explain that to me.
Okay.
My mind is whirling.
If one has a hypothesis about a particular thing, if the construction of that hypothesis drives you to make a certain conclusion, that's not good, and that's not really what you want to do with it.
Yes.
So keeping an open mind.
Okay.
I guess I'm getting
let's recap. We've talked about the scientific method, gone over some of its history. We've pointed out the first few steps. Ask the question, do the background research, construct the hypothesis, and then test your hypothesis by doing an experiment, like measuring the cream filling in sandwich cookies. And the next step, which we'll talk about when we get back from the break, is analyze your data and draw a conclusion. And this is where you really need to be objective.
Right.
That's
okay.
what sets
okay.
the scientific method apart.
And
to be honest, scientists aren't always that objective because
we're
human too, and we like to prove our theory, and we figure that'll make us look cooler at the cocktail party.
And my theory is bigger than your theory.
It's theory envy.
Right.
So we'll discuss that and many other riveting tales of science and technology after this break. You're listening to Inside the Black Box WREK Atlanta.
For a full schedule of WREK's programming, as well as a live playlist and a 7-day archive, visit our website at WREK.org. Who knows, you may find something interesting.
I am stuffed.
After that meal, I have got to pass gas.
Powder room's right there.
No!
Daddy's gas can kill us all!
That's right. Toxic clouds like the one I'm about to unleash could make everyone deathly ill. Be right back.
Secondhand smoke contains hydrogen cyanide and other deadly gases.
What a guy.
Oh, he is a keeper.
Don't pass gas. Take it outside. Get the facts at don'tpassgas.org. A message from the Ad Council and the American Legacy Foundation.
Parents, you have long tried to protect your children from drugs and alcohol. Now there's a way. A preventative method so effective that once you've heard it, you'll wish you had written it down. So, grab a pencil and paper and listen closely. Here's how it works. First, combine ground beef with egg, tomato sauce, breadcrumbs, and spices. Shape into a loaf and bake in oven-safe pan at 350 for 50 minutes. Serve hot. It's called dinner. And studies show that children who eat dinner with their families are less likely to smoke, drink, or use drugs. This is Jamie Lee Curtis encouraging you to have dinner with your kids every day, including Family Day, September 24th. A message from CASA, the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. For more information, visit www.casafamilyday.org.
Daddy, when you look at me, I could see your wheels turning. About what am I going to be when I grow up? A major league first baseman? Maybe a point guard for a national championship?
The odds of a child becoming a professional athlete are 1 in 16,000. Far-fetched? Maybe. But did you know the odds of a child being diagnosed with autism are 1 in 166? That's right, 1 in 166. To learn the signs of autism, go to autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we just discussed one of the steps, test your hypothesis by doing an experiment in the scientific method.
Right, so we're talking about the scientific method today, what it is, what it isn't. And it's one of these things where you think it's cast in stone, but there's not like a guidebook that's precisely followed. It's more like a certain way, code of
isn't
behavior.
Isn't that the difference between science and religion, science and philosophy? Nothing is carved in stone. Anything can be tossed out at any time.
Yeah, there's a bit of a dogma associated with it. Why, you know, sort of talking about religion. I mean, there's a bit of a dogma, but it's kind of a gooey dogma. I mean, it's not really...
Gooey dog. I think I picked that up when I walked my dog.
I stepped
on a daily
gooey
basis.
Dog when I was running last night. But go ahead.
Okay, so we were just talking about the next step. Once you've done your experiment, analyze your data and draw a conclusion. And this is where the objectivity of science becomes most important. That is, if there is anything carved in stone, being objective. And one of the basic rules of the scientific method is you are not allowed to ignore any data.
Right.
And this is a pet peeve of mine. Mm-hmm. Right. They teach elementary and high school kids, you know, how to determine an outlier. Oh, that's an outlier. I can throw that out. Technically, there is no way to determine an outlier. Mm-hmm. Unless you say, look, you know, here's what we think went wrong with that experiment.
And what is an outlier?
I mean, when you measure, you know, the mass of an Oreo cookie and it's, you know, 1.6 grams, 1.6 grams, 1.6, and then 3.9 grams.
Or you know, 0.6 grams, which means that you took a bite out of it.
Right, exactly. Like so you want to throw it out because it messes with your fit, your theory, mm-hmm. your model. And you can, provided mm-hmm. you can make a decent argument that something went wrong with the experiment. And the way you figure that out mm-hmm. is you do it 10 times
right.
or 100 times. And if 99 out of 100, you still get the same answer, then you probably can. But there's no fundamental way to do it. Mm-hmm. All those rules you learn are simply saying, look, if the distance that it's away from the rest of the data is, you know, five times the standard deviation, right. it's probably
well, inside. And it, you know, and this applies to surveys that are done as well.
Absolutely.
I got a call once and for once didn't hang up on them, and they were asking, you know, it was a survey about news programs. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, fine. And they said, well, which news program do you watch? And I said, well, I don't watch any of them. It's all negative and biased, and it's of no value to me. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, do you watch, you know, 2020? Do you watch CNN? I said, I don't watch any of them. They hung up on me. I'm a valid data point. The fact that I'm tuning out.
Right. Right. That you hate them all.
And
like most people, actually.
You know, well, you know, that I don't, that I mistrust them all for good reasons. And right. you know, in terms of, I mean, the point of the surveys is to get information back to the stations about what to play so that you will entice the viewers that have disposable income and the, mm-hmm. you know, and the advertisers are happy and all this, for them to hang up on me. They just threw out me as a data point.
Yeah.
And actually I'm a very important. So they're left with the people that will stop at an ambulance when there's a wreck and stare inside of it. Okay. You know, that's who they're left with. And they should have
alienating the news listening public.
Yes. And you know, so I guess my point is
right.
they threw out data.
Yeah. And that's a bad
you
thing.
You know, and they do this
the
in
point
surveys.
Is that happens though, because we're human. Scientists and the scientific method, the peer review method mm-hmm. is better than anything I think politicians or mm-hmm. business people do. It's
right.
very objective relative to that.
Right.
But relative to an absolute standard of objectivity, we are humans too.
True, but
and
I guess
scientists
but see,
cheat
these,
and finagle as well. Just not as much as
politicians. We'll get into that in a minute. But I guess my point is that even something like that, a survey especially, you know, should be done with the scientific method of not throwing away data and not being biased. And so this person was, I'm supposed to go. This person was just an employee and I don't think thought through too much, but they were supposed to ask people which news stations they liked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, me saying none of the above, that's an outlier. They threw that out.
Right.
So
right.
they were sifting through to get to the people that will watch the train wreck and, you know, ignore the people that aren't, that are tuned out.
But I think the lesson here is that if the data refute your mm-hmm. theory, and this mm-hmm. is tough for scientists to accept. We have a theory. We've traveled around the country. We've given mm-hmm. talks on this. And scientists, they're very territorial. Mm-hmm. They're no different than NASCAR commentators. They're like,
right.
well, Jim, I think he's just a bad driver. And
right.
you don't want somebody to mess with your theory. Same thing, mm-hmm. too. That's my theory. Don't mess with it.
Right.
But you have to eventually admit
there
this is what we first
element.
Thought. It's wrong, mm-hmm. and Brad was telling me I should use an example from my own research. Mm-hmm. We're working with an interesting polymer called poly-2-ethyl 2-oxazoline, and it's a polymer for a long time based on some
Dang.
Very good
Can you
work.
Say that again?
Poly-2-ethyl 2-oxazoline?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually not that different than a protein, believe it or not. It's a
really?
Synthetic polymer, and there's some very good work that came out of Virginia Tech that suggests that it might form a coil mm-hmm. and be, you know, the sort of rigid structure and
so
solution.
What's it good for? So a coil like
Well,
a
actually,
spring,
if it forms
right?
a coil, it's very good as a – we thought it would be good as a flocculant for paper, to get paper fibers
flocculant?
To get paper fibers to stick together.
I thought the Catholic flocculant. Church outlawed
no,
that
that's
in
flagellation,
the 1600s.
I believe.
Oh, self-flagellation.
Okay. So, but it turns out it doesn't form a helix if you look at the viscosity mm-hmm. data. And to be honest, we did a
helix
lot of light
is
scattering.
A springy kind of –
Well,
atomic
actually,
structure.
Like a peptide, like DNA, it winds
right.
in a helix, and it's this mm-hmm. rod-like structure. Mm-hmm. None of the data indicate that. So we had to change our hypothesis. Now we actually think it's either a random coil like regular polymers, which means it's really boring and it doesn't have nice viscosity modifier properties like you put in hair. You're like your hair gel. It makes it more viscous. But we think it may also be a, what is it, maybe a coil that folds back on itself, like a protein, which is a very unique structure. And we have one experiment in looking at how it behaves when you shear it in solution. You put it between a cone and a plate and you spin it very fast. One experiment suggests it might be that way. And the first thing you do, we're repeating that now. Because that one experiment could have had an impurity, could have had an air bubble, could be a million things to do.
So there again, you know, an aspect of that is repeat the, is the experiment repeatable?
And do that before you draw a conclusion. And if you want to see an example of people who didn't do that, who rushed to draw a conclusion and move to the last step, which is also important, communicate your results, I recommend Yes, We Have No Neutrons, an eye-opening tour through the twists and turns of bad science by A.K. Dudney. And this looks at everything at the
Is that his really his actual name?
D-E-W-D-N-E-Y. Hey, Dudney. Okay, right. You're making fun of everyone's names today, aren't you?
That's what I do.
And this deals with, obviously, the whole cold fusion thing. And I think the cold fusion thing is an illustration about how we are human. Fleischmann and Pons, I don't think are bad scientists. I don't think they're
bad.
You know
what, Julian Schwinger, who shared the Nobel Prize with Feynman, wrote several papers towards the end of his life, theoretical in support of cold fusion. They were not published by the APS journals, American Physical Society, so he canceled his membership. Nobel Prize winner. Go ahead with your slam.
I actually know other people at Caltech who have published theories of how that works. And the point is, it's okay to speculate on that stuff. I think these guys were faced with an experiment, and it had it been a normal experiment that they were going to publish in the Journal of Physical Chemistry, they would have redone it several times. They would have checked for what we eventually discovered, the temperature variation of their neutron detector, which actually was discovered by people at Georgia Tech. That was one of the problems with the experiment. But when you are on the verge of the greatest discovery of the last millennium, and you think, well, should I publish now and maybe be proved wrong or hold back and have somebody scoop me? We're human. They went for it.
Well,
and they were wrong. But a lot of times we're wrong.
I contradicted
my hypotheses in journals as well.
In 1976, when I was graduating from college, a group at Berkeley circumvented the peer review process to announce they had discovered the magnetic monopole. So what is that? Well, it's a single charge of magnetic material, if you will. And so an electron
has an individual charge. It always has two sides.
There's a north and south pole.
There's never one without the other.
And so this was, we have discovered the magnetic monopole. That means we got to change a term in Maxwell's equations and Gaussian form of that. So it changed all this stuff. They went to press conference before ever getting this peer reviewed, and somebody on campus at Berkeley came out and said, we say that all the time. That data just means it's a cosmic ray.
It's a cosmic ray in their experiment.
So they didn't, gamma
ray from way out in space messed up their experiment.
Gave them the result that they thought was a magnetic monopole. They didn't go through peer review process. They jumped everything, went straight to the press. And, man, did they look silly.
You know? But, you know, that's okay. That's why the last step is important.
Not really. They were pretty much roadkill after that.
But, I mean, the point is science is supposed to be open and honest.
But they didn't go through the process of the peer review.
That's why you communicate your results.
They could do it, and they could say, gee, we think this is what this is. But I think there's a tendency if you go in – you know, with hubris and throw something out there, you're going to get a problem. And what is peer review? Brad's bringing up an interesting question. Guy wrote his great penmanship.
Well, because we communicate the results, and there are two ways to communicate the results. One is to the general public, which actually I think is becoming more and more important.
Like on a radio program, for
example. Well, people don't appreciate what scientists do and engineers and researchers. So that is important. But peer review is the way you traditionally communicate that.
So you you will write up your results and you will submit that to a refereed journal, and the refereeing process.
And this is not a guy in a black and white striped shirt.
Sometimes we wish it was. But you'll send it off and they will look at it, the independent reviewers, and you will get a range of things. Almost seldom, if never, will you get publish as is. This looks great. I think one paper in my group in my career has come out that way. But it's usually, what about this? What about
right,
the other
thing? At the
very thing?
Least,
about,
they'll correct typos.
Yeah,
things that are
something else
that are not clear.
Like, we're not
right.
so sure about this, and you'll get some.
And sometimes they'll say it's garbage.
Yeah,
you
and sometimes that's biased that you know what
yes.
they come up with.
Yes.
And you have to fight that or deal with it. But the point is that somebody else took a look at it besides you. Somebody took a look at it besides you.
Right.
And so, you know,
and
you've
said,
got
this
that.
Is a, meets a reasonable standard.
Right, right.
And usually and, more than one person.
Right. And to just go straight out to the press and go, here it is, this is a wonderful thing, that's where you're in serious danger.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's continue talking about the scientific method here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Of the 1.3 billion people living in absolute poverty, 70% of them are women. Why care?
I've learned better farming techniques and have been able to grow more potatoes than my family needs. Selling them at the local market has allowed me to send my children to school.
Why care?
I am powerful.
She has the power to change her world. You have the power to help her do it. Visit care.org.
If you're not facing your mortgage issues, this can be the most terrifying sound in the world. It means you've fallen behind. It means hope is dwindling. It means you're another call closer to losing your home to foreclosure. Fortunately, there's hope. If you need real help and guidance, call 1-888-995-HOPE. That's 1-888-995-4673. Because nothing is worse than doing nothing. A public service announcement brought to you by NeighborWorks, the Ad Council, and this station.
Want to support WREK? If you would like to underwrite, visit our underwriting page on www.wrek.org or send us an email at business.manager@wrek.org.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about the final step, according to sciencebuddies.org, mm-hmm. in the scientific method. That's communicate your results. And Bill was explaining what peer review is, mm-hmm. right? That it goes right. in this journal, gets looked at by, you know, one or more other, mm-hmm. hopefully objective scientists.
Right.
And it's not perfect, but it is better than
right.
you know, politics
than
and
just,
other places.
A lot better than just slinging it right. out there.
But we are, in fact, a bit biased. And the whole reason we do peer review is that somebody needs to reproduce your experiment. Mm-hmm. And if you don't explain enough for them to reproduce your experiment, I'm always nagging mm-hmm. my students about this. You have to put in all these little parameters mm-hmm. so that somebody can reproduce it. And if for some reason you accidentally left that off, somebody emails you, mm-hmm. you know, the thing that, yeah, this is, we use two mm-hmm. for that value. You try that, see if you can reproduce it. Because that validates mm-hmm. what we did, and then they may try taking it one step further.
Right.
And I refer to an anonymous letter to the editor of Nature Biotechnology, which is considered a premier journal. Mm-hmm. Nature
right.
and Science,
British,
two of the best right. mm-hmm. journals in the world, and Nature now has various sub-journals like Nature Biotechnology. It's entitled, Where Did the Scientific Method Go? And it refers to a brief communication published by Mazur and co-workers in the May issue of this journal. And it contained what is becoming an increasingly alarming trend, not only in this journal, but many other so-called top-tier journals, a lack of documented methodology and information that is essential to faithfully reproduce the science claimed in the manuscript. So full disclosure is what you must do, and you want someone to reproduce it. I mean, if you watch the movie Contact, have you watched the movie Contact?
I have.
So Jodie Foster was in there, and they were getting this signal that had non-natural patterns mm-hmm. to it. Prime numbers repeating over again. That is not a non-natural pattern.
Right.
What do? They call the guy in Australia mm-hmm. and say, do you get the same thing? Do you find the same location? Yes. And that tells you that it eliminates any problem with your equipment mm-hmm. or your approach,
right.
like this cosmic ray you were talking
right.
about before.
Right.
So very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you want to go to Einstein next?
Yeah, we can. What was the other point you wanted to make about reproducibility and communication? Well, let's go to Einstein.
So this famous thing, Einstein...
Famous thing, that's the technical word for it?
Yeah, jeez, this guy. We're going to have to start going to...
we need more caffeine before we go in the studio.
Okay, so Einstein's general theory of relativity, which sort of commenced 1907, and I think he sort of completed everything in 1916. And one of the things that he predicted was that light would be bent by stars. So, which is something that Newtonian mechanics did not predict.
Yes.
And there was a, of course, people know when these solar eclipses are coming. Of course, you couldn't see it with the technology because the sun was too out. You know, it's out in the middle of the day. You can't see it.
And light coming from behind a large star would travel through. Isn't it actually the space that's bent and it travels?
Yeah. So, I mean, space is
defined. But you would see it as bent.
Would see it as bent. Anyway, so Eddington, who was a he was actually in prison in World War I, in England because he was a conscientious objector. They let him out of prison to do this experiment. He sent, so Arthur Stanley Eddington, he sent one expedition to the coast of Africa, another to the coast of Brazil. And during the solar eclipse, they were measuring the location of this particular, apparent location of this particular star, which was effectively behind the sun.
Right.
And he declared that the light was bent, so the data from Africa indicated that it was bent.
Mm-hmm.
And what didn't come out till years later, and so this touched off a big firestorm of, this is when Einstein became famous.
Right.
You know, this wacky general theory of relativity thing was right. Yeah. You know, here was this experiment.
And that makes a good point. Hypotheses must be testable.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and so he had this testable hypothesis, the theory predicted it and all this, and here, voila, it was right. Well, what turns out to have happened was that Eddington, the data from Brazil supported Newton's idea that it wasn't bent, the light wasn't bent.
Right.
And he just threw out completely the data from Brazil.
Yeah.
And
there could have been a problem with the Brazil experiment.
That's what he claimed.
You're not allowed to not say that.
Right. So he threw it out. And so, and point of fact, and they make in one of these blogs here, I'm not going to be able to get the site very easily, but it turns out that it wasn't until 1959 that we had the technology to do this experiment with enough precision to say that Einstein
was
right.
So that's it turned out he was right. So nobody gets
upset. Turns out he was right.
But there's a 50-50 shot he could have been wrong.
Yeah, right? But I mean, that was the case of a scientist, a well-known scientist, and I believe he became Sir Eddington, you know, went in with his hypothesis overpowered him. His hypothesis...
Yes.
I am going to prove Einstein right, because in reality, the data was inconclusive.
So, for example, going back to that folding of this polymer polyoxazoline, we've got some data that suggests it folds this way. At least it's consistent with that. The interesting thing is the difference between it just being random and having this weird protein-like structure, not a big difference. So that is tough.
Yeah.
We've got three models, three simulations we've done. One of them says... it's not doing this. Two of them says it does.
Right.
And that's okay, but you have to include that one model and say, look, by the way, this one, you know, when you actually put the water in it, which is important, it doesn't really indicate this is what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
There could be a million sources of error. It's a simplified model. We'll mention those, but you have to mention and say, so it's a little inconclusive. This is what we speculate, but it's not, you know, carved in stone yet.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what you do in the scientific method.
Right, exactly.
And that will save your face later because maybe we'll realize we're completely wrong, but at least we had some data to suggest that. Okay, so we've gone through the entire steps of the scientific method as given by the Science Buddies website, www.sciencebuddies.org. Ask a question or have stumble on the question, usually a problem if you're an engineer. And that is the difference between scientists and engineers, right? Scientists endeavor to understand Mother Nature. Engineers endeavor to rip her off.
Right.
Right. We want to use the result of our experiment.
And part of that is understanding it well enough.
Yes. Yes.
To use it.
So ask a question, do background research, construct a hypothesis, then test your hypothesis because it must be testable. Analyze your data and draw a conclusion, hopefully unbiased by, as you said, your hypothesis.
Right.
And then communicate your results, hopefully first, in a peer-reviewed environment, and then hopefully to the general public.
Right.
And the reason things don't get communicated to the general public right away is because oftentimes they are revised over and over and over again.
Right.
Literally a decade later, when we really understand the phenomenon, that's when it goes
on. Well, and an extreme case is archaeology. You'll hear these things. They'll announce that there was a 400,000-year-old man in Cleveland.
Right.
They found it 15
years ago. I think I met him
ago.
At a deli,
actually. Yeah, you
actually.
Did. Yeah, actually, he was at one of your gigs. loved the jokes
about the old people.
About the old people, yeah.
I did a lot of those.
But I mean, archaeology is really bad, good, whatever about. It's been in the process 10 or 15 years before it ever gets released to the public.
Right.
A lot of that stuff. So.
But that's okay. Report it in a peer-reviewed journal and realize
there
are limitations.
It's frustrating for the archaeologist because, things are there. Things aren't getting looked over. But there's just, in that sort of subset, there's such a subset of the field, there's such a desire to peer-review, make absolutely certain about something.
Right. Publish or perish. So, yes, are people rushed to publish? Yes. Yeah. And there is some pressure to do that.
Right.
Because
we
live in a society.
Right.
It'd be nice if we were completely objective.
Right.
So what have we learned? We've learned that the scientific method has a few simple steps. Take this initial question, do background research, very important. Mm-hmm. The librarian will explain that to you because maybe it's been done.
Mm-hmm.
Then construct your hypothesis, make sure that's testable. Then test the hypothesis. And then when you analyze your data and draw your conclusion, do not let the hypothesis, as you pointed out with one of Einstein's theories, overwhelm the data.
Exactly.
In fact, I probably hold the record for disproving my own hypotheses. And then finally, communicate your results so that other peer scientists and research engineers can reproduce that, analyze it, see if it's logical, and then eventually goes out to the general public and hopefully is used.
Yes.
So, and I think we've learned that that objectivity about your hypothesis is very important.
Yeah, and scientists and engineers are human too, so there is a propensity at times to not quite live up to the full intent of that.
But
we try.
Really,
we keep trying.
Gets me going is when politicians say, well, these scientists can't be troubled. They're just trying to make money off this science and this global
warming. We're not making that much money.
That's preposterous.
Yeah, we're not making that much money.
Right. Have you seen my car? You would know that I am not making that much money.
Mr. LQM, low-quality mail. But go ahead.
Okay.
I remember from
back to a previous show. Social insects,
because
I've got a bad car.
Yeah.
There are some scientists that are trying to get something out of this. And what are they trying to get? They're trying to get grant money. They're trying to get popularity. And that's not good.
They're not.